Welcome everyone to the Elemental Awakening. I'm Gio, and today I got a special guest, Patrick McEwen, author of The Oxygen Advantage and a few other books. He is a breathwork facilitator, coach, speaker, and does a lot of many things, helping many people around the world. And I'll let him probably give a more detailed introduction as to all the things that he does. But first off, I just want to welcome you to the show, Patrick.
Sure. Thanks very much, Gio.
Yeah. So Patrick's going to share some of his wisdom with us today, and I promise you it will be transformational for many people that can apply some of these practices to their everyday life. I've seen it in my own life and many people around me, and I'm sure Patrick can share a few stories of some crazy transformations he has seen. So you're going to want to listen to this one, and I'll let Patrick take it from here and give me a bit of an introduction of who you are and I guess any titles you may give yourself or how you present yourself out in the public.
Typically, if people ask me what do, I typically say I write books.
You write books.
And I probably for years, because breathing wasn't very hot. And it wasn't a team that was very well respected. And if you talk to somebody about their breathing, they'll tell you that their breathing is good, that they breathe well. And I think there was a lot of that over the years. So as a result, then I kind of always steer clear of it. So if they write books, if they ask me then, what do I write books about? I said, I write books about health. And that's it. I kind of leave it at that. Mm. So my background is I came across breathing because it completely transformed my life. And that was 22 years ago. I had chronic asthma. With that, I had very much a sleep disorder breathing. I had undiagnosed sleep apnea, waking up very tired and very much fatigued in classroom and school, all the way into my universities, and that impacted concentration. It impacts your mood, and it impacts your ability to do physical exercise. So quality of life is very much reduced as a result of breathing problems. And asthma is so common. It's affecting about 10% of the population. And many people with asthma, because of inflammation of their lungs, it travels up to their nose, so they have a stuffy nose. And because of having a stuffy nose, then they mouth-breathe. And mouth-breathing then is activating the upper chest with faster breathing. So it's more fight or flight response, sympathetic activation, but sleep is impacted. So, I put breathing through the nose and light breathing into practice, completely changed my life around. So the point that my background is in economics, and I studied for 4 years in that discipline. And then I changed careers, and I moved from economics then over to teaching breathing. And that was back in early 2000. So this is where it's being at, and I suppose putting the information out there, I was writing books since 2003, but also working with a lot of clients. So over the years, thousands of individuals, adults coming in with issues, about 30% from a health problem, 30% were coming in with asthma, 30% coming in with anxiety and panic disorder, and 30% coming in with sleep disorder breathing. And then children. Many children who are mouth breathing, the impact of, asthma and anxiety on young kids, their concentration, their sleep disorders, getting children to breathe through the nose. And then the aspect then in terms of performance would be using and applying a specific breathing technique to help improve performance in sports, in athletes, both recreational and elite. And also with first responders, military, police personnel. So there's it's quite varied now, the application of breathing. So now, if somebody asks me, what do? I'll probably tell breathing, but now maybe not, who knows?
So you're one of the OGs, I guess, in the breathing space, at least the modern breathing space, from my perspective anyways. You've been doing it for quite some time and just really pushing that message forward, writing books, speaking about it. And I'm sure you've noticed all of a sudden, it seems like there's this new interest where everyone's like, wow, this is simple. This is not so difficult. I can't believe how I feel, or maybe you're hearing about the transformation. So I guess, how's that experience been for you as far as why do you think now all of a sudden people are paying attention to their breath? Is there anything that you can
don't know? I don't know. I think part of it is due to the Wim Hof. I think it was the popularity that he was able to put out there. There's no doubt that part of it is due to the Wim Hof technique, that it got a greater awareness. And I think the issue was that, when people think about breathing, they may associate it with yoga, or they may associate it with mindfulness. And, breathing is much more than that. Breathing is much more than just targeting the biomechanics of breathing. you look at what we can do through the breath. We can open up the nose in a few minutes. We can help open up the airways. We can help improve somebody's temperature, increase the temperature of their fingers by changing their breathing patterns in 3 or 4 minutes. We can activate the body's relaxation response. We can lower blood pressure by slowing down breathing. So we can influence blood circulation, oxygen delivery, airways, concentration. We can upregulate, put the person into a more stress kind of, you know, concentrated state, or we can downregulate, put them into a very relaxed state that they get sleepy and yawn. And we can influence the autonomic nervous system, stimulating the vagus nerve, increasing heart rate variability, improving the sensitivity of the baroreceptors, influencing the autonomic nervous system of the body. And I'm not saying that this is a cure-all, it's not at all. But breathing is not just that thing about taking a deep breath or a big breath. Breathing is not that it doesn't matter how you breathe, whether it's through the mouth or through the nose. And I have heard, you know, medical professionals say it doesn't matter if you breathe through your mouth or through your nose. Well, ultimately, the mouth is not for breathing. The mouth performs no function in terms of breathing. And if you take air straight into your mouth, it goes straight down your throat. And your nose is specifically designed, the organ, you know, specifically designed to condition and filter and moisten and regulate breathing volume. And the connection with the nose, with the diaphragm, connection with the diaphragm and the mind, connection with the diaphragm and the upper ear with the later muscles during sleep. I think it's amazing, you know. And I'm grateful that it has, because we were seeing it. Sometimes we were wondering, well, you know, why isn't it getting out there? And there was a resistance to it. And it's been amazing. Okay, on one aspect, my workload has tripled. And even since COVID, it has doubled, you know, in the last 3-4 months since March. And that's an adjustment for me because, you know, I'm writing a book, or I've just submitted a book for publication. I just submitted it on Monday. It's 140,000 words. And it's looking at aspects of breathing that haven't been altogether covered. They have been covered, but they haven't been put out there. For example, the effect of breathing on epilepsy, the effect of breathing on diabetes, the effect of breathing in women's health, that women, you know, have different breathing very much to males, you know, because young women, especially during the monthly cycle, the impact of hormonal changes on breathing, and also how the hormonal changes on breathing is changing breathing, changing biochemistry, and this is increasing pain perception and reducing pain thresholds. So there's so much more, the relationship
breathing and osteoporosis, breathing and functional movement. Right? Sorry, the last one you said, functional movement?
The relationship between breathing and functional movement. You know, many athletes understand about the importance of functional movement, but you cannot have functional movement unless you have functional breathing. So I think, Gio, I suppose, it's not that I'm trying to complicate it, but I didn't realize the depth to which breathing could go, because with Buteyko, I focused primarily on biochemistry, and it was biochemistry for so many years. And now with Oxygen Advantage, we've opened up biochemistry, biomechanics, heart rate variability, breath holding to cause stress or hormetic change, to force the body to make adaptations. And it's amazing. And the more I teach it, the more I realize just how much I don't know. And we don't know it. It is vast.
It is. It's literally incredible. And I'm very similar to you. I'm a geek in this stuff. And every time I find something else out, and then like the science is not even that complicated when you really see what's happening. It's like, oh, that makes so much sense. Like I just recently learned about overbreathing and osteoporosis. And when you look at like the sort of theory behind why that happens, where the pH in the blood is trying to sort of normalize by releasing bicarbonate in the urine, and then that leaches it from, you know, other places, which potentially bones. And it's like, wow. Then you have all these older people that are overbreathing and, you know, osteoporosis. Yes. Like, wow. Oh my God. Like that makes so much sense. And I'm so excited about your new book.
Part that I haven't looked at, osteoporosis and breathing.
Okay. Right. Like there's so many interesting things. And I know you said it's not a cure-all, but I guess my question to you is has there been anyone that seriously tried to improve their breathing and has not seen any improvements at all? Is there any cases that you've seen that just like Stonewall, like find an overbreather, change their breathing habit and not seeing improvements in anywhere?
I think if you find an overbreather and if you slow down their breathing, you're going to have improvements on some level.
Somewhere. And
those, definitely. those levels will include improved sleep, especially if you have your mouth open. You know, the amount of people that sleep with a mouth open and they have disrupted sleep, they have lighter sleep, and this has been shown, you know, and it's shown that fast breathing, and mouth breathing is fast breathing, that if you breathe fast, you're more likely to be aroused from sleep. So then you have sleep fragmentation, and then you're waking up feeling tired, or you're having to go to the bathroom during the night. And, you know, just by getting the mouth closed, even with that, any individual, getting their mouth closed, breathing in through the nose with the tongue resting in the roof of the mouth, it increases their heart rate variability. And we can measure now, like using HRV, you can clinically measure the degree of stress or the degree of recovery or resilience or autonomic balance with that individual. You know, I think that's important, even though I'm very poor in terms of technology, and I'm very kind of more, when I work with a student or a client, I simply look at their breathing and I pick up on the speed and the depth and the regularity of the breath and where they're breathing, and are they cough for breath. So I observe. Typically, I don't use technology, but I think technology is really kind of providing a basis that there's something in this. That's what technology is doing, on the basis of heart rate variability. And it's not just about the biochemistry. Like, this is the other thing, you know, with breathing, many people, we get stuck in our own little silos. With Buteyko, we were focusing primarily on biochemistry, and we were pretty much ignoring the biomechanics and ignoring heart rate variability. The yoga instructor or Pilates instructor may be focusing primarily on the biomechanics, and they are ignoring everyday breathing patterns. They ignore the biochemistry because maybe they're telling their students to take full big breaths, you know, take in as much oxygen as possible and get rid of as much toxins. And then you've got a heart rate practitioner, you know, counselor working with heart rate variability. Their focus is on coherent breathing, but they aren't looking at the biomechanics and biochemistry. So even within the breathing world, we're all in our own little silos. And that's why I said it's so important to open it up and to look at it from many different perspectives as best that we can. And again, it's not to complicate it, but it's realizing that there's a depth to breathing. And why not explore it?
Yeah, it's interesting. On the drive into the office this morning, I was thinking about, you know, like, why not create a breathing summit where you have all these experts from different philosophies coming together and just like a 20-minute talk on like the similarities and the different perspectives.
Yes.
And also, yeah. My yoga teacher, well, my good friend of mine who studied in India, he was telling me that, you know, like the breath work was really at the core of the yoga practice. The Western yoga is all about the glamour of the yoga body and, you know, people trying to be more spiritual. But he said his sort of philosophy is that all of these postures is to open up your ability to breathe better and to get into the actual pranayamas deeper, using the breath as a tool to go in, not so much about, you know, like overstretching or being fitness. He said, so that was an interesting sort of point to add to what you just said. And I have so many questions because we're jumping a bit all over the place, but you talked about HRV. From my own experience, I've struggled a bit with my HRV. And I found is because my mind was overactive when I go to sleep. So I'm an entrepreneur. I'm someone who's always busy, always working, always thinking. My mind's always like in a million places. I love it. Yeah. But when I started tracking HRV, I noticed like my nighttime scores were just down and my mind was overactive and taping my mouth, seeing small improvements. I started noticing like if I focus on meditation or focus on breathing, I can bring my HRV up. But it's when I'm not focused, mainly when I'm sleeping, it's like things start to unravel. So in the morning, I'll do a meditation. And if I'm extending my exhales or doing like an extended box breath or like a 5-5-10 ratio, all of a sudden HRV starts climbing right back up really quickly when the CO2 levels increase. And I think like a lot more research needs to be done in this area and to see how, like, I can see it in one sitting, a difference and measure it with just like an Oura ring, right? So I'm excited about that. I'm excited that other people are also looking at these things. I'm not like a technology like buff in any means, but you know, now it's, these things are much more available, where I think in the past you need to go to like a laboratory or like a high end sort of multi-million dollar facility to get some biofeedback. And now the biofeedback is coming to everyone's hands. So we can really get some immediate feedback. And I think that will also help people see a change. You know, they can have a little bit of belief like, wow, like, there's something here that I can see and measure. And The other thing that I love about breath work without the technology is people feel the difference on the first try. Whether it's the Wim Hof, whether it's reduced breathing, whether it's holotropic or transformational breath, there's an experience that happens in one sitting. Like, I felt the difference. There's something here I need to explore more. So before we get to that, because that's one of my questions, you mentioned Buteyko a couple of times. For those that are listening that don't know who Buteyko is, you want to give a really brief synopsis on just who he is and what he sort of realized that changed the way we look at breathing?
Sure. He was working with his patients, and as a medical doctor, he's a trained medical doctor, and he's from the Ukraine. And working in, I think he was working in Moscow. And this was back in 1957. So when he was working with his patients, he started to notice that as his patients got sicker, they started to breathe faster and more upper chest and harder breathing. And he asked a question. He said, is it their sickness which is causing their faster and harder breathing? Or is it their faster and harder breathing which is feeding back into their sickness? And he started teaching his patients to breathe through the nose and to slow down their breathing. And many of the individuals that he worked with, first of all, were people with asthma, but also with people with high blood pressure, people with different complaints. And, you know, in Russia, they were using this, the Buteyko method, for about 90 different conditions. And it was only when the fall of the Iron Curtain back in 1989 or thereabouts, that Buteyko, the technique, got out of Russia into, it came first to Australia in about 1992, 1993, and to the United Kingdom in 1994. And I came across it then in 1998. And I trained then in 2002, and I went to Moscow to train, and I was lucky because Dr. Buteyko was still alive, and he passed on the following year. So his whole thesis was centered around carbon dioxide. And that was the available research at the time. You know, and he used carbon dioxide as an explanation of people having asthma, for example. He said that the person with asthma is breathing too hard, too fast. They're losing too much carbon dioxide from the blood through the lungs. And this is causing their airways to constrict. Now, that was his theory. And, you know, science has moved on. So we now know that if you breathe too hard and too fast with asthma, well, if you're breathing through the mouth, you're not harnessing nasal nitric oxide. If you're breathing hard and fast, you're causing cool and dry air to come into the lungs, and that causes bronchoconstriction. And we also know then that people with asthma can have reduced heart rate variability, that the autonomic nervous system is impacted. So Buteyko's technique was correct, but his theory was the best theory that he had at that time. But his exercises still stand today. Now, medical people have rejected the Buteyko method on the basis of the theory. They have completely rejected it. But very few of them have actually looked at what the Buteyko method involves. What does it involve? It involves teaching people to decongest their nose holding their breath. Known since 1923, if you have a stuffy nose, if you hold your breath, you can open up your nose. Teaches people to nose breathe. Teaches people to lower and slow down their breathing volume. Slow down their breathing volume. And lifestyle guidelines, for example, don't overeat. Cold water immersion, by the way, was a principle of Buteyko. So it was a principle of Buteyko back, and it wasn't part of my training. So that's why probably, but originally in Russia, it was more so rolling the immersion in cold weather or immersion in snow. But that was the principle of the Buteyko method.
I had no idea about the cold side of it, but
And fasting as well.
Fasting
as well. But like, though we've had 20 clinical trials on the Buteyko method for asthma, I know that you're based in Canada. If you were to ring the Canadian Asthma Society and ask about, well, do you recommend your asthmatic members to breathe through their nose or mouth? Probably there's nothing on it. And I think it's really unfortunate, because how on earth can you protect the lungs unless you use the nose to breathe in the first instance? So, you know, it's not enough. It's really not enough just to give people and children medication without helping to change their breathing patterns. Because I use my own self. I didn't just have asthma. I was tired all the time. My concentration was impacted. And I was in that fight or flight, that mood. And it's not easy. You're like, your quality of life is impacted. And when we look at breathing, we cannot just isolate the impact that breathing has on one function of the body, because breathing can influence different systems and organs throughout the body and in different ways. And that's why that, yes, if you are taking medication for asthma, address your asthma. But even with obstructive sleep apnea, you know, we've been using breath all time to give some feedback of chemosensitivity to carbon dioxide, because it's not oxygen that drives breathing. Every breath that we take into the body, it's not driven by oxygen or lack of oxygen. It's driven by an increase of carbon dioxide. So breath hold time provides you some feedback of the chemosensitivity to carbon dioxide. And in 2018, Dr. Messino, a Harvard medical doctor, looking at one of the characteristics of sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea, used breath hold time to measure the chemosensitivity of that individual to carbon dioxide, and concluded that a low breath hold time is characteristic of what he calls high loop gain in obstructive sleep apnea. And that is a characteristic that's feeding back into the condition. So again, your takeaway was correct. You know, so I find it amazing that, you know, something can be rejected on the theory not standing up without actually investigating, well, what did he say, you know? And first, do no harm. What harm is there in telling somebody to breathe through the nose? What harm is there in telling somebody to slow down their breathing? What harm is there in telling somebody to engage their diaphragm breathing muscle? And it's not about taking the big breaths. You know, in terms of our everyday breathing, I understand that, say, with the Wim Hof technique, you want to induce a stressor, you want to induce hermetic change. So there is hyperventilation followed by breath holding. But we also, you know, from my perspective, I want to stress individuals coming into me, but I want to do the stress according, because I've made mistakes. I've made loads of mistakes with this CHEO. I've had people coming in over the years with panic disorder. And I mean, like, from 2010 to 2013, economically, Ireland was in a really bad shape. There was a lot of anxiety and a lot of panic. And I was doing courses bringing together functional breathing and mindfulness. And we had many people coming in with panic disorder. I would have them reduce their breathing to increase CO2 in the blood, to open up blood flow to the brain. But I didn't realize that many of these individuals have a heightened sensitivity to the suffocation, that they have a heightened reaction to the buildup of CO2. And I put them into panic attacks. So I've made plenty of mistakes with breathing. I've had people coming in with chronic fatigue syndrome. I give them exercises to induce adaptations and I floor them. You know, but that's changed, because this is what 20 years of teaching something teaches you. Mm-hmm. We have to tailor breathing exercises to suit the individual. I can't go into a group of individuals and all start telling them, now we're going to do extreme breath holding. Now we're going to do even reduced breathing, because I don't know how those people react, and I could push them the opposite way to which I need to do it. So that's, you know, this is, experience is a great teacher. And I suppose I'm privileged that I have, you know, I have learned a lot in terms of breathing, but unfortunately I've learned it by making some mistakes, but that's the way it goes.
And people who would have chronic fatigue or increased, like, a really high anxiety disorder.
Yes.
What would you recommend for them to get started rather than building up CO2, just normalize it? Like what would be something?
Yeah, but you have to be very, very careful. So somebody coming in with a high anxiety, if they have an overly suffocation, if they have an overly sensed of alarm to the buildup of carbon dioxide, you'll tip them into a fight or flight and you'll put them into panic. So when somebody comes in with anxiety, first of all, I'm measuring their Bolt score, the control pause. I'm looking at their breathing. And then I typically start them off with small little breath holds, holding, breathe in, breathe out, hold the breath for 3 to 5 seconds, let go, breathe for 10. And I don't start off at 5 seconds. I actually start off at 2 seconds. I see how do they react, build it up to 3 seconds. How do they react? 4 seconds, 5 seconds, 6 seconds, 7 seconds. And then I have them do light, slow, reduced breathing, just softening the breath and slowing down the breath to the point of air hunger. But I only do it for 30 seconds. And then I take a minute's rest, 30 seconds, minute's rest. And then I ask them, how are they responding? Because I need their feedback. Whereas before, I would have them do it for 5 minutes straight. And if they get stressed, I'd say, okay, you're stressed, keep doing it. Wrong thing to do. So now we do it for 30 seconds, minutes rest, 30 seconds, minute rest, and we gently build it up. And with chronic fatigue over weeks, I build up bringing in small breath holds every day, you know, throughout the day. Extending, first of all, well, keeping the dose fairly okay, the air hunger pretty light, and having a small duration. And then I increase the dose and I increase the duration over a period of time. And then maybe 4 or 5 weeks into it, then I give them breath hold walking. And then I start stressing them. But I'll only stress the body when I've got to a certain level. Because if I stress the body on day one, it's too much for them. So it's a few weeks
into it. You base that level on their bolt score or their control.
Yeah, I base it on their bolt score, but I also base it on how they're feeling.
Feeling as well.
You know, so how are they reacting to it?
Mm-hmm. And that's all how is their your book. Breathing? People can learn all these techniques in Oxygen Advantage. You talk about the bolt score. You talk about some of these practices if people are interested. Awesome. And how long would you say like these practices usually need to take place before it becomes autonomic again, where it just becomes their natural breathing? Is there a set thing that you've seen roughly, like how long it takes to reset someone's breathing patterns?
Well, you know that your breathing is getting a little bit reset when your bolt score is increasing. So every time your bolt score increases by 5 seconds, typically you will see some changes there.
So breathing it could take anywhere from...
Well, if you bring somebody from 10 to 15 seconds, that's a huge change for that person. Mm-hmm. 15 to 20 seconds is a big change. You know, 20 to 30 seconds is a big change. So when you see a 5 second improvement of their bolt score, typically they will have slower breathing. They would have an increased natural pause between breaths. They're more likely to breathe using the you know, like if we look at bolt score, what feedback is it telling me? Well, if you have a bolt score, a low bolt score, you typically breathe faster in upper chest and you have no natural pause following exhalation. And as the bolt score increases to about 20 seconds, the natural pause following exhalation improves and you breathe more towards the diaphragm and you're slow breathing. And also the bolt score is interesting because there is a relationship between the chemosensitivity of the body to carbon dioxide and, you know, the bolt score is measuring part of that, even though there are other influences on the bolt score. But the bolt score is some feedback of the chemosensitivity of the body to carbon dioxide. When you have an increased sensitivity of the baroreceptors, which are pressure receptors in the major blood vessels, which are monitoring your blood pressure, that if our blood pressure increases, the baroreceptors immediately react by sending a message to the blood vessels to dilate and the heart rate to come down to normalize blood pressure. And conversely, if the blood pressure goes low, the baroreceptors immediately react by constricting blood vessels and increasing heart rate to normalize blood pressure. And the sensitivity of these baroreceptors, these pressure receptors in the major blood vessels, provide you very good feedback of the functioning of the autonomic nervous system. And it may be that it's the sensitivity of the baroreceptors which are modifying heart rate variability. But as you improve the sensitivity of the baroreceptors, you reduce the sensitivity of the body to carbon dioxide. And to reduce chemosensitivity of the body to carbon dioxide is manifest in a higher bolt score. So it's not that we see that everybody with a high bolt score is high HRV, but there is some interplay there. And I think some of this is still being untangled, you know, mm-hmm. like what is influencing HRV? Mm-hmm. Is it the baroreflex? Absolutely. Is it mm-hmm. the vagus? You know, like
probably really... multiple different things that change for every person. Just quickly, for those listening, bolt score, can you just tell us what that means or what it stands for? And a very, very brief, explanation. Sure.
Bolt score was put together. The name itself came from one of my colleagues called Tom Heron. And you call it the body oxygen level test. You know, even though it kind of gives you more feedback about carbon dioxide than oxygen, but you can't call it the carbon dioxide test because people will say, oh my God, carbon dioxide. You know, one guy sends me in a post during the week. Oh, you're saying about carbon dioxide. Why don't you tell me just to lie in the ground and to inhale the fumes coming from somebody's car exhaust? I'm just thinking, okay. So carbon dioxide typically has bad press, you know. And so you don't call it carbon dioxide. However, if you have a good tolerance to carbon dioxide, if you can tolerate, you know, with normal breathing, and if you do physical exercise with a good tolerance of carbon dioxide, it's the CO2 and the drop, the resultant drop to blood pH, that causes the affinity of hemoglobin for oxygen to be reduced. In other words, our red blood cells release oxygen in the presence of carbon dioxide. So oxygen delivery from the blood to the tissues and organs is influenced by carbon dioxide, and that's why we call it a body oxygen level test, BOLT.
And so basically,
it goes as follows.
Oh, good. Perfect. That was my next question. Yeah.
Take a normal breath in. Well, you're sitting down for, say, 5 minutes. Then take a normal breath in and out through your nose, and you pinch your nose with your fingers, and you time it in seconds until you feel the first definite desire to breathe, or the first involuntary movement of the breathing muscles. And then you let go and breathe, and your breath at the end should be fairly normal. Now, where's the science? There are a few papers going back to 1975. Most recently, a paper by a professor of physical therapy called Kiesel, K-I-E-S-E-L. He studied 51 subjects, 27 years of age, and he looked at their breathing from three different dimensions, biochemistry, biomechanical, and psychophysiological. And that's to determine if there is a breathing pattern disorder present. He concluded there was no direct correlation between the three dimensions of breathing. And an easy way to screen for breathing pattern disorders was to use the BOLT score. You take a normal breath in and out, pinch your nose and hold, and just time it in seconds until you have the first definite stress to breathe.
And the definite stress for me is tricky. So it's not just a little bit of air hunger. It's like...
No, it's not just a little bit of air hunger. We have to think of it this way, that if you stop breathing, at some point the brain is going to react. And when is it that the brain reacts? The brain will react maybe by sending an impulse via the phrenic nerve to the diaphragm, that the diaphragm jerks. So you have involuntary movement of the breathing muscles. That's one aspect. Or you have the first stress to breathe. And that's the BOLT score.
Beautiful.
And just to conclude on Kiesel, he said that if your BOLT score is above 25 seconds, there is an 89% chance that dysfunctional breathing is not present. Now, he also tied in four questions from the functional movement screen. Do you have cold hands? Do you yawn frequently? Do you feel tense throughout the day? Do you wake up with a dry mouth in the morning? They are all common symptoms associated with breathing pattern disorders. If you have a breathing pattern disorder, it's very common that you have cold hands, because if you're breathing too fast, too hard, your blood vessels are constricting, so your blood circulation is impaired.
Mm. Interesting. Okay, a couple more questions for you. Great chat. Thank you for all this amazing information. Just going back to Buteyko, you're talking a bit about how he observed people who are in the hospital or sick, and he wasn't sure if it was the increased breathing that was making them sick or the sickness that was increasing the breathing. Now, we're doing this podcast at the tail end, or hopefully the tail end of COVID. Seems like it's starting to... move in that direction. And I get a lot of questions. And one of the questions that, you know, I've had a conversation with someone is, there is this video on the internet and of a nurse saying how anyone who's going on a ventilator was passing away. And there was one case of a guy who basically could not be sedated because he was a drug addict and the sedation wasn't working. And he woke up, ripped all the stuff out and was able to get away from the hospital, and he survived. And then she was questioning whether or not these ventilators are a good thing or not. Now, I'm not asking you that question. My question is, you know, if a healthy person was put, if someone with maybe overweight or diabetes or asthma or something like that was also put on a ventilator, what do you think would happen to them, regardless whether they had COVID or not?
Well, if we look at some, you know, in the book, I put a chapter about cardiovascular health. And I cited references to a number of studies which were conducted back in 2004, 2007, and maybe more recent. But it looked at rescue personnel, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, CPR, that emergency personnel who were overzealous, you know, doing the best that they could do. They came to the victim, but they overventilated the victim, and it was resulting in death of the victim. And it's, you know, I don't know why, what's the precise mechanism here, but if you hyperventilate, especially with somebody who's vulnerable, you are causing blood vessels to constrict due to the loss of carbon dioxide, and coronary blood flow reduces. And the heart, so isn't getting, may not get sufficient blood flow, but not only that, the hyperventilation or overventilation causing a left shift of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. So less oxygen is getting delivered. So the heart is not just responsible for pumping blood throughout the body, but it needs its own blood supply and it needs its own oxygen supply. So that may be one aspect of what's happening. And, you know, the papers talked about these newly identified risks of overventilating victims, but none of this is new, because back in 1907, Yandel Henderson was an expert on blood gases from Yale University, and he conducted rather kind of gruesome research with dogs. He administered air into the dogs via the trachea using hand bellows. And when he pumped more air into the dogs, he was able to drive their heart rate up to 200 beats per minute. And when he slowed down the air going into the dogs, he lowered their heart rate down to 40 beats per minute. But he killed many of the dogs in the process. So we have to realize that as human beings, there is, you know, it's not about overventilating, because it just doesn't make sense. You know, and of course, like, I've seen it and I've seen the reports about the ventilators, and I haven't gone into all that much detail with it, but breathing is something that we can do to help with COVID, you know, and very simple stuff. You know, if you go into a supermarket and there's some guy coughing, well, hold your breath, you know, hold your breath and walk away. Or if you're in a crowded place, like I remember in March, I was in London and I was on a tube, and it was really, this was rush hour, this was jam packed. And I was saying, okay, this is crazy, you know? And I minimized my breathing for 40 minutes because I wanted to reduce the viral load. The duration I couldn't influence because I was stuck in that place for 40 minutes. But what I was going to breathe in for that duration, I was going to reduce. And the other aspect is we have to consider that the nose is the body's natural defense mechanism. And, you know, I'm not saying that nasal breathing is going to stop COVID, but what I am saying is that whatever chance you have of helping to defend your body against COVID, you don't have much of a chance if you have your mouth open. And if you look at doctors back in the 1920s, they said that patients with TB, they were more likely to be mouth breathers. Now, was it the TB that caused mouth breathing, or was it the mouth breathing in the first instance that risked or increase of TB? And if you look at the work of Professor John Lundberg from Karolinska Institute in Sweden, that the gas nitric oxide from the nasal cavity, first identified on the exhaled breath of the human in 1991, is antiviral and antibacterial. Mm-hmm. And in laboratory experiments, the administration of nitric oxide and SARS-CoV back in 2005 showed that nitric oxide prevented the replication of the virus. Now, World Health Organization is talking about washing your hands, having social distancing, no mention of nasal breathing, and no mention of breathing light, just simple things. And the other thing is, when people do get COVID, they do have respiratory distress, those people who are symptomatic, and this will result in fast and shallow breathing. Fast and shallow breathing is totally uneconomical, because all you're doing is you're ventilating fast, but you're breathing shallow. And also you're leaving a lot of air in dead space proportionately. So you could be, for instance, if you were breathing 20 breaths per minute and the tidal volume was 300 mil, which is about six liters per minute. In that instance, even though you're taking 6 liters of air into your nose or mouth, only 3 liters is getting down into the small air sacs, because 3 liters is staying in dead space. So here's an instance whereby when we need air most, we typically respond by breathing fast and shallow due to the feeling of suffocation. But that fast and shallow breathing is only feeding back into the suffocation. So instead, we need to have our hands either side of our lower ribs and to really slow down the breath and slow down the breathing to 6 breaths per minute during rest. Take a larger tidal volume with a reduced respiratory rate. This enhances alveolar ventilation, this improves gas exchange, and this will show an increased SpO2 or SaO2. And again, something that's an issue with people with COVID, that their blood oxygen saturation is dropping into the 80s. Even during recovery, post COVID. And there is a way to enhance alveolar ventilation, to improve oxygen uptake, to improve oxygen delivery. So whether one is climbing a mountain and you want to breathe in a way that's more efficient, or if you're having an asthma attack, or if you're having COVID, and it doesn't involve overbreathing. It's not about overbreathing, because then we're sacrificing the biochemistry. It's about the interplay between the biochemistry, the biomechanics, and the cadence of the breath.
Amazing. Another trick that I tell people too, and you probably have heard of this one before, it's called Brahmari breath. It's a pranayama that when you're exhaling, to exhale, you hum. You make a humming noise in your nose, and it's been shown, study, to increase nitric oxide up to 15 times, 1,500%. So that's just like free antiviral support that you can just create whenever you want. And you don't need to go get a prescription or fancy equipment. This is something that everyone has access to all the time. So I always like to tell people, look it up. There's videos online. It's not that hard. Just hum, make feel the vibration in your nose. And all those cavities are going to produce extra nitric oxide. And then inhale, maybe not a deep, sharp inhale, but just a regular, slow inhale back in through the nose. And
There are. There are studies showing it 15-fold, even 20-fold. And the other thing is about people who are infected with COVID, they should be told to breathe in and out through the nose. Because you can imagine a family member who's infected with COVID, and they're inside in their home, and because of their labor breathing, they're... You know, they're fast breathing through an open mouth. And one of the ways that it's being transmitted, that it's being accepted to be transmitted, is via airborne particles. Mouth breathing emits a greater proportion of airborne particles. There's a 42% greater water loss through the mouth than through the nose. The nose traps the moisture on the way out. So we're wearing masks in the instance of trapping the moisture. So we're helping to reduce the spread of the infection. But how about nasal breathe? And also, while you wear the mask, it's very important that you breathe functionally while wearing the mask. Because I remember I was just getting my hair cut done about 4 weeks ago, and the barber had a mask on, and I was listening to his breathing, and I could hear he was mouth breathing and fast breathing, and he was a young guy. And obviously, when he was wearing the mask, he was feeling a little bit of air hunger. So he was reacting by fast and shallow breathing. And it's no wonder he's going to be fatigued or headache or all of those symptoms that are associated with wearing a mask for a prolonged period of time. Wrong way to breathe. You know, if we're telling people to wear masks, we should be telling them to breathe while wearing the mask for prolonged periods of time.
That was actually my next question about mask. I get that all the time. You know, my perspective is the mask itself is not dangerous. It's how you breathe with the mask. Obviously, making sure that the mask stays as clean as possible. The moisture from mouth breathing or even nose breathing is going to create a very warm, moist environment for bacteria, fungus, viruses to sort of live in. But aside from that, you know, does it pose any risk, in your opinion, to wear a mask? A lot of people ask me this question. Should I wear a mask? Should I not wear a mask? So you should follow what the government is telling you. I'm not going to tell anyone to break the law if there's a law to wear a mask. But the actual breathing with the mask, what's your perspective on that?
You just sort of in terms of the blood gases, you know, if you think of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as 0.04% of atmospheric pressure, but carbon dioxide in the lungs is 5%. So when we breathe out, you know, we're breathing out a pressure of carbon dioxide that's, you know, of course it's going to be higher than what's in the atmosphere, but the body needs higher CO2. Now, of course, when we breathe that into the mask and then we are re-breathing that carbon dioxide back, but carbon dioxide, the body's very sensitive to even minute changes in carbon dioxide. A 2 to 5 millimeter increase of CO2 will double ventilation. So the gas doesn't have to increase by all that much for you to feel air hunger. But here's the thing. If you were to consistently have good breathing and functional breathing, you have a better tolerance of the gas. And as a result then, you know, you're not going to have as many symptoms if your BOLT score is high. And the other thing is that as carbon dioxide increases in the blood, it's causing a right shift of the oxyhemoglobin dissociation curve. Hemoglobin is going to release oxygen more readily. So in many people, they're going to have actually increased oxygen delivery throughout the body. Now, as hemoglobin releases oxygen more readily, it will show a drop in their blood oxygen saturation if they were using pulse oximetry. But the drop in the blood oxygen saturation is not necessarily a bad thing in this situation, because it will be due to the hypercapnic response because of the increased oxygen delivery. So, you know, I put a video out on YouTube about a month ago on this, and, you know, there's so many comments and criticisms, and, like, I'm not here to talk about the politics or the ins and outs of all of that, and people have their own opinions. All I'm here to show is that, you know, this is, you know, from my own field in 20 years that, yeah, you know, that the body is able to tolerate carbon dioxide, and it is normal that you will feel air hunger if you have poor breathing, but there is a way to breathe to help reduce that air hunger. And, you know, I think that's important for people to realize that if we have to wear masks, we have to wear masks. And listen, I don't want to get COVID. We are seeing emails coming in. Last night even, we have one of our students post-recovery from COVID. 5 months, 4 months. This is crazy, you know. The recovery is long and the recovery is slow. And, you know, I'm not saying that with everybody, but this is not a condition. This isn't a flu that's lasting for 2 weeks and going away. And this is not just for people who are older. We're seeing younger people that are having a hard time recovering. So I think we have to be realistic here. You know, if it's just as simple as wearing a mask, and if you have to do it anyway, like, if it's going to minimize the risk, I'm only sorry that the World Health Organization, that they haven't looked at nasal breathing versus mouth breathing, but that's typical. Medical doctors don't know the difference between the nose and the mouth anyway, you know?
That's part of our mission, to spread the word and educate people, you know? And
yeah, that's it.
That's what sort of inspired me to, like, we teach at our center here. Now we have a new breathwork course. It's all about proper breathing mechanics. You know, we started with, like, the Wim Hof and some of these deeper exercises, but I realized that we're not helping these people if they're not breathing properly on a daily basis. We're pushing them into these, like, and they're having great experiences, but same as you, it's like some people that their system is not ready for these huge fluctuations in breath holding and high CO2 and then high oxygen, low oxygen, you know, like that could be putting a lot of stress on the system. So we're like, our fundamentals course is, let's teach them how to breathe properly, breathe less, and, you know, graduate them into these deeper experiences.
And just a point in terms of nasal breathing, there was a paper published by Elsevier about a month ago, and it talked about the anecdotal evidence about wearing mouth tape to reduce the viral load during sleep to allow the immune system to launch an effective response. Now, taping of the mouth has always been the controversial thing with the Buteyko method. We've used taping for 20 years, and for children, of course, it's going to be problematic. And a few months ago, I brought out a tape called Myo Tape, and it's my own tape. And it's not that I'm doing a shameless plug, but I think mouth taping is really, really important. You could use 3M micropore tape that's going across the mouth, obviously not suitable for people who are apprehensive or for children. And the other option is, if you do wake up with a dry mouth in the morning, I would say, get the mouth closed and look at MyoTape. It's not that expensive. It's $25 for 90 strips, and that will cover you for 3 months. But you'll have a much better night's sleep. If you have your mouth closed during sleep, you'll have a much better night's sleep. And even with obstructive sleep apnea, studies show that the severity and the frequency, in terms of the severity of AHI, the apnea hypopnea index, is much higher, much stronger severity if you're mouth breathing during sleep versus nasal breathing.
Beautiful. Yeah, I recommend that to many people about mouth taping. And I do it myself. And my HRV has been increasing. So that's all I can say is that it's hard to notice the difference. You know, I don't think I was a mouth breather, but sometimes you don't realize because you're sleeping, you know, and even if there's a couple hours in there of mouth breathing through the night, you know, it's going to make a difference. So, thank you for pointing that out. I guess my last question for you, I know we got to go, is, you know, some of these like breath work practices like holotropic breathing and transformational breathing and the Wim Hof method that induces these altered states of consciousness. Do you have any experience with those? And what is your perspective on those types of practices? As far as, are they good, bad, combined with proper breathing? Like what, just curious about your take on those.
Yeah, I suppose my take on it is that because I've been trying to address chronic hyperventilation for 20 years, I'm probably a little bit fearful in teaching hyperventilation because it was something that we were looking to address. In terms of the benefits that people are getting, there's no question that we're getting feedback that people are getting good benefits. So for people who are practicing them, that many people are going to benefit from them. One question that I would ask is that, can you use the same approach with everybody, just as I was using and I realized that I can't? And the second question is, how do you assess risk people versus non-risk people? The third question might be, is dropping your blood oxygen saturation down to 40%. As human beings, we've never really had to do that throughout our evolution. At what point does a stress become too much of a stress that it's going beyond the adaptative response? Another question that I might ask is, what about your functional breathing and your everyday breathing? And what about people who are in that sympathetic activation that, you know, I understand, like from holotropic, for example, or how is it happening? And I'm not sure if people really will know how exactly it's happening, but it's almost that you're pushing the state into such an extreme sympathetic state that it's causing the body to just reset, that it's almost that you're switching, you know, the retuning button or the reset button. And that's maybe what's happening. But then I think that if people are doing upregulation and hyperventilation and breath holding, spend some time downregulating afterwards and consider, how is your everyday breathing? How do you breathe when you walk to the shop? How do you breathe when you're asleep at night? How do you breathe when you're getting stressed? You know, consider how you breathe during physical exercise. So I think, you know, I think it's a wonderful technique, you know, holotropic or Wim Hof, or they're all really good and they're all very beneficial. Wim Hof has been tremendous in putting breathing out there. But is it something for everybody, or should something be more used more selectively, and different approaches to suit the individuals? I suppose with many, you know, issues like sleep apnea was traditionally seen for 40 years. It was seen as an anatomical issue. And only in the last few years that researchers are realizing that there's four phenotypes or characteristics of sleep apnea. Only one of those now is anatomical, three are non-anatomical. So with experience and with hindsight, we learn. And it'll be interesting to see what's the story in 5 years' time and 10 years' time.
Awesome. That's a great answer. Okay, so... what was the one tip you'd give to someone who is unaware of their breathing, if they're listening to this podcast, where would they start? And this is the last question.
Start observing it, you know. I spent 20 years completely stuck in my head, completely immersed in thought. I would go down a street and I wouldn't see the street at all. I was thinking, living in my head, missing out on everything that life had to offer. My mind was racing. It impacted my concentration. I wasn't able to sustain my attention on a subject matter. And as a result, your quality of work suffers. You're more likely to be anxious. You know, we have to think about what is the breath, but the bridge between the mind and the body. Focus on your breathing. Get your attention out of the head. Breathe in and out through your nose and gently slow down your breathing. And even slow down your breathing for a few minutes here and there, to slow down your breathing that you feel air hunger. And that's, even start with that, you know, observe your breathing, get your attention out of, even just observing the breath is a great start. Don't live stuck in the head. You know, it's not human beings. We've almost been indoctrinated to think that thinking is good. We need to bring a stillness to the mind. Focusing on the breath will do that. And while you have your attention on your breathing, ask yourself, how are you breathing? Is it fast? Is it slow? Is it upper chest? Is it low? Is it more with greater amplitude of the diaphragm? Is it through your nose or through your mouth? Is it regular? Is it irregular? Connect with your breathing and measure your pulse score. That'll give you feedback too.
Amazing. Thank you so much. And just breath on a breath per minute basis. I know most people are probably, what, 18 to 25 on average breaths per minute.
Well, if you'd hope that they're, you know, like 20 years ago, it was typically seen that normal breathing, normal respiratory rate was between 12 and 14 breaths. Now we are being told, when I look at medical journals, etc., that the normal respiratory rate is as high as 18 breaths per minute. It's not. It shouldn't be above 14. You know, we shouldn't be even breathing 16 breaths per minute. So what is seen as normal is changing in 20 years. And unfortunately, it's going in the wrong direction. You know, our breathing shouldn't...
What would the optimal, according to you, like, what do you think is the optimal range that people should try?
Well, if you have 10 to 14 breaths per minute, you're good. In a nice range.
Good. Amazing. Okay, so tell us how we can find you. Where's your website? Do you have any social media? And any news about the book release? Is it still a few years away? Or anything you want to plug here or let people know where they can reach you for information? Because I'm sure they have lots of questions after this.
A resource for taping of the mouth is what I talked about. That's myotape.com. And if I can just do a brief demonstration, I know this is totally shameless plug.
I love it. Go ahead.
I'm doing it because it's the one thing that kind of puts people off a little bit. And the tape is, to give you an example, you can see the tape on the mouth. So it comes in strips like this. You take off the strip. You stretch it about 30%. You place it around the mouth. And it brings the lips together. So it's the tension. So you're getting nasal breathing during sleep, but without risk. And it's a training tool for children. We also have a free children's program on YouTube. If you put in Patrick McKeown, breathing exercises for children, all of the exercises for kids are completely free. For sports, it's oxygenadvantage.com. And we have the science up there in terms of nasal breathing, functional movement, intermittent hypercapnic hypoxic training. That's using simulation of attitude training, using breath holds, etc. And then for health, it's buteycoclinic.com for asthma, for panic disorder, for people with sleep disorder breathing. So there's three websites, myotape.com, oxygenadvantage.com, and buteycoclinic.com.
Amazing. And the book you mentioned in the beginning, any timeline as to when you're hoping to get that out or...
Yeah, I haven't an idea because all I know is that it's a little bit technical. So what I'm forecasting is I've sent it to my book agent, Doug Abrams, and he's going to say, Patrick, this is a great resource. The only thing is I need you to rewrite it again because it's too technical. So that's what happened with the Oxygen Advantage. And hopefully that's not what he comes back with. So, you know, by the time it goes through the hoops and people come in and they give their own insights into it and things like that, we could be talking a year down the road.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. If you need anyone to read a draft just for feedback, I would just be so curious as to what you're putting in there. And any way that I can support you, reach out. I love your work. Thank you so much for all that you're doing, spreading this information. A lot of it you're giving away on your website and your YouTube channel. And I know it's really, really helping, like, so many people out there. And the more we sort of teach people how to take control of their own health, the better, you know, we're going to be as a collective. So thank you guys. Please follow Patrick, look him up, check out all of his stuff. And I appreciate you guys tuning in and listening, and we'll see you soon. And just one more big thank you to Patrick.
Great. Thank you, Gio.